to the Code Navy podcast, where we talk to people on their coding journey in hopes of helping you on yours. I'm your host, Saran, and I want to tell you about our incredible sponsors, like DigitalOcean. They've got simple cloud hosting built for developers. And for all the code newbies who just started learning to code, yes, that means you. They've got one-click solutions for Rails, Django, Node, and much more, so you can get your app launched in no time. And if you're looking for full control of your server, they've got that too. You can use the promo code CODENEWBIE to get a $10 credit. So check them out and let us know what you think. We're also supported by Dev Bootcamp. They are an immersive coding school that takes you from beginner to full-stack web developer in just 19 weeks. They've got campuses in New York City, Chicago, and San Francisco. The next cohorts start July 27 and August 17, so in a few weeks. You can apply now by going to devbootcamp.com. So if you've ever been stuck, like I have many times, trying to do something with HTML or CSS, you've probably Googled it, and you've probably come across the blog CSS Tricks. Well, today, I am so excited to have the creator of that pretty famous blog, Chris Coyer. Chris, you want to say hi?
Hey, Saran, thanks for having me.
That was the happiest hello I think we've had on the show. It's also July 4th, so I feel like, you know, we have lots of reasons to celebrate.
Just imagine that with fireworks going off in the background and rocket ships or whatever else.
You know, I think that the fireworks are really for this interview as well.
Yeah. Oh, I think so, too. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So. A little kind of a co-fireworks.
Shared fireworks. So let's talk about CSS tricks. So for, I think most people know what that is who've done some design and front-end work, but for people who are not as familiar, tell us what CSS tricks is.
Yeah, what a dorky name, right? Ugh, you need to change that. It's too late though. Too much brand equity going on there.
But don't you hate when you pick the name and you just can't do anything about it?
Yeah.
You just can't. You're stuck.
And it's not like, you know, can't is strong because I literally could change it if I wanted to, but it just seems like there would be more trouble than it's worth potentially. And nobody, I don't think anybody hates it really. It's just kind of, dorky sounding. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't necessarily regret it. I mean, there's CSS in the URL, which probably doesn't hurt for, mm-hmm. you know, for SEO reasons and stuff, but yeah, CSS tricks, you know, it's not really, you know, and once in a while I'll get a stray comment on it. The site is a blog essentially, but there's other features on it. There's forums there. I do screencasts and post them there. We kind of break the content into, there's a section called the Almanac, which is every CSS, at the moment, every CSS property and type of selector. And then it just, you know, so it's a little bit like MDN or whatever, except for it's just me and it's in my words. And I shouldn't even say just me anymore, because there's a handful of us that now kind of work for CSS Tricks and help with the writing and stuff. So most of it is just me, but some of it has been commissioned work and people that work for CSS Tricks. But for example, there'll be an article on, you know, the before selector in CSS, and it will explain what it is and why it exists and what it's useful for and what the browser support is and that kind of thing. And those are organized in a different way than the blog posts are. The blog is just a blog. I, you know, choose a topic and write a blog post on it. And there's not necessarily any, you know, relationship from one blog post to the next. So but that's been around for a lot of years. Yep.
Yeah. I was going to say, you started in 2007.
Yeah, in fact, I started in 2007 on July 4th.
Really?
So today is the 8th birthday party for CSS Tricks. Thanks very much. Yeah, I always do. Just this morning, I was working on I tend to do a little, you know, celebrational post for it just to be slightly reflective of the year and stuff.
Yeah. So when you started in 2007, did you know it was going to have all this other stuff? What was the initial intent when you launched it?
The initial intent was that I was getting a kick out of learning CSS, and I just thought it might be kind of fun to write little posts about it. You know, I'm not sure that I had a super grand vision. You know, I was young then, but the idea was that I had some other blogs that were related to it, that were kind of help blogs for other software, some of the like Photoshop and InDesign and stuff. Like I would have blog posts on those sites about, oh, I have this error code, what does it mean and how do you fix it, kind of thing. And the idea behind those was essentially to have them be SEO friendly and put some Google ads on them and see if I could make $20 a month, you know, selling Google ads. I mean, it was as simple as that, really. Just kind of looking at people that were making a little bit of a side income blogging and how kind of cool that was. And I was like, I think that's really cool too. So I had this little mini network of blogs. They were all garbage, you know, just poorly done and not particularly interesting and whatever. It was just kind of but the CSS Tricks was kind of a part of that, but I liked that one the most because that's where I'd put the most energy into the posts and you know, and kind of share little bits that I was learning and stuff, and it was kind of garbage too, but I got a kick out of it because it just CSS just kind of clicked with me back then, and I was enjoying it. So when all those other blogs fell away, CSS Tricks stuck around, and I kept trying to do a better and better job with it.
So usually when people have successful blogs, at least people I've talked to, they say, you know, I did it because I thought it would be helpful to my own learning and it got so big and popular that eventually it became, you know, whatever it is now. You started it saying, you know, I saw people making money off this, so right. I wanted to do that, which I like. I like that honesty. How did that reason shape the creation of CSS Tricks? Did you do specific things that would make it more SEO friendly or more attractive to ads and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't particularly successful at the goal of making money. In fact, it was the worst performer of all those for a while. So that was, you know, it's always been a part of a larger reason why I've kept it around. You know, like I want it to be a business. In fact, you know, years and years and years later, when I was able to kind of quit my job and work on CSS Tricks closer to full time, I mean, It is kind of my full-time job now, although I work on other projects as well. So I guess they're kind of all part-time. But it's not like that was the driving motivation for every single decision ever made on CSS Tricks. I mean, I wouldn't want people to think that I like, I don't care about the community. I don't care what people learn from it. I'm just, you know, if it's SEO, I'll put it on there. You know, that's definitely not my, I have a little bit more journalistic integrity than that, I hope. Yeah, but it is always there as a reason. You know, like if I'd attempt a redesign, part of the things that I would be thinking about is what can I do with the ads? Can I make some space for one over here? Can I get rid of these ones that aren't performing well? What, you know, because for the most of the history of CSS Tricks, the only way that it made money was through display advertising, be it Google Ads or you know, what was really popular for a lot of years was these little 125 by 125 ads. You know, you still see those around. I don't really do many of those anymore, but that was kind of a way, you know, like, oh, gosh, I'm serving four of them here, but if I jiggered things around, maybe I could serve two here and two here and two here, and then I'd have six, and then that would, you know, maybe that would make slightly more money, you know.
Those kinds of things,
you know, but what I was writing about wasn't, it was usually just whatever I thought was interesting in web development. What I was writing about wasn't like, here is a review of the, you know, the Nikon D60 L21, you know, because I was like, oh, somebody's going to Google that and then I can, then my ads will be worth more money.
Yeah. So at what point did the site become successful, popular enough that you were able to do it? Or more full time than you were before?
It was, you know, there was definitely several years of posting nearly every day that it was making nearly nothing. So I definitely look back on. Yeah, it is a long time, but I just didn't care because I just, you know, I had another job and I would get satisfaction out of it in other ways. You know, people reading your article and commenting and sharing and stuff, that's kind of motivation in itself to keep writing, I find.
Oh, yeah.
But I think back on that time all the time because, you know, people ask me advice on getting started blogging and what's in it for you and just any kind of conversation that ends up being about blogging. You got to realize that you could and can and probably will write as often as every single day and for as long as several years with almost no traction at all. Mm-hmm. So if you're not ready for that, then you're not ready, I would say, you know? You just be aware that not everything you write is, you don't get to jump to a point where you have thousands of subscribers and active comment threads and you know, little Twitter storms for every post you publish. You haven't earned that yet, you know?
Yeah. And I think that the point you made earlier is interesting, right? Because there's almost this idea that if you are doing something for the community, you cannot also make money. Like it's almost like those two are not inherently mutually exclusive, right? And so you are obviously doing this because you love it and you enjoy it and you care, but you also want to make a little bit of money on the side too, and that's perfectly fine.
Yeah, well, thanks for agreeing. I've always felt that way. I just have no, I almost don't even have patience for people who think otherwise. Mm. That I don't have some right to make money off of the hours that I spend in a day. Why is this so different than any other? Nobody has any problem with most other professions thinking and acting in that way. People generally are pro business, I find, you know.
Yeah.
Like, you spend all day working and you expect to be compensated for that? Well, yes, I do. Thank you very much. You know?
Who'd have thunk?
Yeah.
So tell me why people love CSS Tricks so much when, you know, it got really popular. And it really is like the first hit on every CSS question that I have. And it's very, very helpful. What is it that makes it such a great resource?
Well, it's a little weird to talk directly to that,
because
I guess I don't know. I mean, I suspect, you know, part of it, you know, is from what I've been told, and some of it I can kind of speculate on, to some degree, I don't know that I'm necessarily like a natural teacher, but I do find myself kind of naturally empathetic towards certain levels of understanding. Maybe because I'm not particularly talented at any of this stuff. Like, I've come to be okay at being a designer and front end developer. Like, I'm not trying to be totally self deprecating. I'm absolutely awful at this stuff, but I am not absolutely naturally talented at it. So anything that I've come across, I've had to earn through just perseverance, you know. And not only that, is that when I learned something then, and now I understand it, that was generally such an escapade that I very much can remember what it was like to not understand it, and what was confusing about it, and what particular things were a breakthrough in my understanding of it. And I think I can write like that. I can write casually, but not like obnoxiously casually, with just too many mistakes and too much stuff like that, you know. And I could use more editing in the stuff that I write, but I do tend to write fairly, you know, first person, casual, you know, relaxed, friendly type of thing. I think people appreciate that sometimes, but then also have these, you know, be able to kind of articulate the moment of confusion and the, I don't know, be kind of lay out chronologically what it's like to solve a problem, or go from not understanding to understanding, or, you know, put my finger on just the thing that's weird about this particular web technology kind of thing. So I think that's why people relate to it. I think they enjoy that kind of thing. And the screencasts are the same way. That goes for writing, but it goes for the screencasting. I haven't done as much of it lately, but I used to do it quite a bit. Is that kind of let me show you something, warts and all, you know, like, I'm going to turn on the recorder, and if there's problems, we'll work it out.
I love when there's problems in a screencast. That's one of my favorite things. I'm like, ha, I'm not the only person who gets stuck and yeah, runs into things. It's great.
Mm-hmm. And it would be annoying if it went on for 15 minutes and it was a missing semicolon, but it's usually not that bad, you know. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And if it is a semicolon, hopefully you see it pretty quickly and you realize that everyone misses semicolons. So you said that you were not naturally talented. What does that mean?
Well, I do think that some people are kind of good at some stuff. That they picked up a trumpet and they were just, something about that clicks with them, and they're just kind of a little bit better trumpet player from day one in trumpet class than the rest of their players. And it doesn't mean that that's going to stay that way forever, because maybe they're also lazy and they don't practice as much, and somebody else that just didn't seem to have as much natural talent for it is going to surpass them through their practicing effort and dedication and love for the trumpet or whatever. And I think that the trumpet there is just a moniker for anything else.
Mm-hmm. So if you are not naturally talented, how do you I guess, compensate for that? What do you do to even the field?
Well, I mean, there's just the one way, really, and it's by practicing as much as I can in some regards. But then there's also, of course, asking for help and working with people who you can trust, and you know, ultimately having jobs that are supportive of that type of approach and that kind of thing. I wouldn't say I'm naturally awful at it either. So,
oh God, hopefully that's not a thing. Yeah, you're just naturally bad at this.
There might be, you know, there's like the classic, like, you know, some people are just, we're just not meant to dance. I mean, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I haven't thought of that before, but that makes me sad. So you are a designer and a developer. Which came first?
Design came first for me. I guess I don't know if that's true. As you know, I was just a typical computer nerd. Like from the second you're able to do that, you know, I think my family's always been Apple people, and we had really early, you know, I had a 2GS and all those things. But I wasn't like programming them at the time. I was primarily interested in getting games for them and then playing the games on them. But that, you know, eventually it led to more. And I was into the, you know, bulletin board scene back in the day where you'd have dial-up modem and dial in and kind of build your own bulletin board. That was kind of fun. But that was like, what am I at that point if I'm running a bulletin board? Am I a designer or a developer? I don't know. At that point, you're still kind of just like a script kiddie, I guess. Because it's not like I was just kind of following instructions essentially and setting things up. And then in high school, I was kind of torn between, I really enjoyed ceramics in high school and I was way into that. And then
what did you make in ceramics class?
Well, it was a little Verona area high school in Wisconsin, and it just happened to have a really good teacher and a really large program for it who exposed us to lots of stuff, but they did have lots of wheels. Mm-hmm. So there must have been 12 in there, which most colleges don't have that nice of a ceramics program. So it made sense that people got into it in Verona, and it produced a lot of kind of good artists. But I was also really into programming. We worked in Pascal at that time, and I remember the teacher was super excellent for that as well. And I think I got more into that. There was definitely like mornings that I was coming in early in the morning just to work in the computer lab and staying late at night just to work in the computer lab. And I was working on my own projects. I remember working on like a networked version of Battleship that I was really excited about. And then when I went to college, I was like, okay, I really like ceramics, but that doesn't seem like a life option thing. They kind of press you into that's in college, you know, they kind of press you into making smarter life decisions than that, from your parents and from anybody, you know, like, what do you want to be an artist or do you want to make money?
It's sad but true. Yes.
Yeah. So I ultimately got the degree at Whitewater, the college I went to, was called Management Computer Systems. And that's what I went for. But it wasn't as fun as Pascal. You know, we started in some lower level languages, and I just didn't like it that much. But I powered through 4 years of it. And then right at the end, when I should have been thinking about graduating with that degree, I was like, you know what, this is awful. And I'm having way more fun with my art friends. So I switched it and went back to ceramics and ultimately kind of got my degree in that, which you can't, you know, it just was a Bachelor of Arts that was focused on ceramics, and I took some design classes. So it was kind of always like, which came first? It was like really neither. They both kind of lived side by side for most of my schooling life, and now still do, because I do feel like CSS is kind of a nice marriage of both design and development. Mm-hmm. It's like it has the arty bits and the programmy bits all together.
Mm-hmm. So how did you go from ceramics to web development? It seems like a pretty big jump.
Well, I mean, it's just I just did it a lot in college, ceramics, and I enjoyed it. And my senior show was in college. And then as soon as I graduated, I pretty much never touched clay again, which is slightly sad. But, you know, I have lots of friends that are in it. I like to go to the annual ceramics convention as much as I can. I still enjoy it. I still consider myself a collector of ceramic art, but I don't necessarily miss it that much. but after college, I jumped right into, I tried to get a job, and it wasn't web at the time. It was like, maybe I should just be a designer somewhere. Cause my degree was Bachelor of Arts, and my portfolio was mostly designy things at that point. And I tried to get a job as a designer, even at like the newspaper or somewhere. They hire a zillion of them. And I just wasn't having any luck, and ended up getting into pre-press, which is the job at printers where they take the documents that designers have built and get them ready for press, which is it was a pretty interesting job. I did that for a number of years before ultimately being like, I know I'm just doing this in the interim before I can get a better design job or a web job was what I really wanted. And ultimately did get one of those and then left pre-press behind forever. So
it's yeah. just
life, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Is pre-press still a thing?
Oh, absolutely. It's a huge profession, and it's very nerdy. And so imagine you designed like a brochure, right? It has two folds in it and two folds in it vertically and one horizontal fold. And it ends up being like a 12 mini page kind of thing. You can imagine mm-hmm. like a classic mm-hmm. brochure that you grab out of a stand.
Yeah.
Well, that probably has color all the way to the edges. So that's called bleed. And bleed is when you need to print a little larger than the area so that when it's cut down, the color goes right to the edge. Because, mm-hmm. a printer can't really print right to the edge of the paper. It should be white around the edges just because of the technology of the printing press. So imagine it's your job to, kind of make sure anywhere that has bleed. And not only that, but okay, this brochure is going to, we're trying to print it as efficiently as possible. And we have these big giant presses in our printing place. We could probably fit four of these brochures onto one sheet of paper. So like, I need to relay this out in that specific way. And I need to make sure that what it gets printed on the backside of this sheet, like backs up perfectly what's supposed to be on the back of it. So it's kind of my job, like the designer isn't thinking about that. They just design it however they design it. And it's my job then to like take the pages they design and relay them out and making sure that what backs up to what. And that all the printer marks are properly on there. And if they've, if they've chosen special colors for their brand, that those are kind of separated out so that, and so the final output for that job is big giant metal plates, and they pay by that type of thing. So if there's full color photographs on there, that's CMYK. That's where that kind of comes from, is that there's going to be literally a plate that's the cayenne plate that has scratches in it essentially that get placed in that printing machine, and that rolls through cyan ink, picks up that ink and lays down just that color on that piece of paper, and then it goes, and then the yellow plate rolls and grabs the yellow ink and presses it onto the paper, and a lot of these big giant offset printers print six plates. So they have CMYK, and then they'll often have an additional one, which might be a spot color, which might be like, I work for American Family Insurance or whatever, and they have some special red color that isn't able to be replicated in CMYK quite as perfectly as if you mixed the paint beforehand. And then maybe like a shiny varnish or something that goes over the whole top, we could use the sixth printer for. So anyway, it's kind of like my job is to get those plates ready for print from a file. So there's just a lot, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's a lot of steps in between it, making sure that, for example, the artwork is as high res as it needs to be to look good in the final product. And it's a whole job.
Yeah, that's a lot of stuff. I had no idea.
It's a little bit like CSS, really. It's like preparing a design for the web is mm-hmm. kind of what a front-end developer does.
So when you think about design versus developer, do those two go together very nicely for you? Do you feel like there's any tension between those two sides? What are your thoughts?
Oh, that's interesting. Hopefully there's not. In a perfect working situation, there isn't. And then, of course, there's some people that can do both, the fabled unicorn of our industry that sometimes it seems like there's more and more of, and sometimes it seems like there's less and less of. I'm not sure anybody has the perfect idea on it, but
I was gonna say, you sound like a unicorn from this conversation.
I don't know. I don't feel like one necessarily, just because if somebody's, could I spin up a little Rails app that took down everybody's favorite lunch restaurant and or whatever, you know, I'm trying to think of a cliche Rails app. Yeah. But I feel like there's a lot of people like spin one of those up and it's like, would I feel 100% comfortable doing that? Probably not. And I would feel even less comfortable making it live on the web because I don't know what to care about. Like, I don't know what kind of security mistakes I'm making. I don't know that type of thing. If somebody else created a Rails app that did that, I would feel comfortable going in and making a new route for some other type of page. And I could probably write the controller that would give me the data I need. And I could probably write the view and put the data in places that I need it to put. So I'm like kind of comfortable as a developer. Like I could work along with that, but I wouldn't want that to be to be solely on me. So I just don't, and then I feel like because of that, I don't get to have my developer card. Aww. I get to have my designer card plus, you know, like developer adequate card or something.
You have points towards the developer card.
Yeah, exactly. I have half a merit badge.
Oh man, half badges. That's sad. That's just like, oh, that's sad. Okay, let's talk about CodePen. Which I believe you started as well, correct?
I did. I started it with two friends of mine who I've been working with for a long time, Tim Sabat and Alex Vasquez. Shout out, fellas. we worked together at a company called Wufoo for a number of years. Little longer than I did. It's a form building web app, PHP, rock and roll. And then it was sold. And we all went together to go work at a company called SurveyMonkey, which even more people are aware of, probably. Mm-hmm. And then we worked there for a couple of years.
Wait, who did Wufoo get sold to?
To SurveyMonkey.
To SurveyMonkey. Oh, I didn't know that. Huh.
Yep. So that, yeah, sorry, that wasn't clear. They bought us, and we kind of mandatorily went and worked for them for a while, which was great. Wufoo was great. SurveyMonkey was great. And we were just kind of looking to kind of do our own thing again, just be a little bit more free and more, you know, try to build something on our own, you know, be a business. So we were always interested in working together because we just had become good friends and knew that we worked together well and had kind of complementary skill sets. So Tim is very good at server stuff, and I mean, he's really, he can write JavaScript too, and he can definitely write backend stuff. We're a Rails app at the moment. He's very good at that too, but not so much HTML and CSS. And Alex is very good at server stuff and very good at JavaScript and architecturally and that stuff. And again, he can kind of do, we're all pretty good at everything, you know, but again, also probably not super great at HTML and CSS. And then I'm kind of responsible for all the HTML and CSS and design of CodePen. So our skills levels overlap, but not too much, you know? So that's the idea. And it was kind of built for CSS tricks in a way. It was that there's other apps that are predate CodePen that do the thing where you can write HTML, CSS, and JavaScript in the browser and see the result of it. The popular ones are JSBin and JSFiddle. They're older than CodePen. CodePen can kind of do that similar thing, but CodePen has this layer on top of it these days of social. You know, you log in and you have this account and you have this profile on there, and people can love your pens and they love you back, and you follow each other, and there's discussion and collaboration, and there's just lots more to the CodePen universe. But the root of it was, let's put these demos for CSS tricks into this UI that is way more clear. You know, like in the early days of CSS tricks, be like, here's a demo, here's a link to a live demo that shows off this code that's in this blog post. And you're like, cool, I can look at the code in the blog post and I can click the link to go over to look at the final result. But those two things are pretty separated from each other. And the best you can do is, you know, view source or use the web inspector to look at what's going on. It's way more compelling of an experience, I find, to be looking at those things at the same time and be able to alter, for example, CSS and see it updated in the live demo of it immediately. Like, this is so cool. It's so good for learning. So we kind of built it for CodePen or for CSS, built CodePen for CSS tricks. Like, let's make this, you know, let's put these demos here. And then it worked out, and we thought we could do a good job with it and kind of grow it up, and just been working on it ever since. And now CodePen is 3.5 or something. It's also, it's not a spring chicken anymore.
Yeah, CodePen is so great, and I love it because it's very inviting. You know, it's not just a really great way to see how things work together, but it makes me want to try things too. You know, it makes me want to go, oh, what if I just change this number to 4 instead of 2? Then what happens? And it just like lowers that barrier to experimenting and playing and remixing the things that other people have made.
Wonderful. I hope so. In fact, we have some great users who, you can do whatever you would like on CodePen, but I'm thinking of a particular user who makes almost nothing of their own. They are known only as a remixer. You know, they'll go find a pen and fork it and mess around with it a whole bunch and save it. And they always, of course, credit the original, and you really don't have much of a choice on CodePen. When you hit fork, we kind of preserve that connection anyway. But yeah, that they make beautiful things of their own that are only remixes of other people's work, which is so cool.
Yeah. So tell me about that community layer. Why is that so important?
Well, it's important because it's fun, for one thing. I think people have some ownership over a site when they sign up and you see your picture next to the things that you've built, and your profile it becomes your kind of profile and kind of, it's like kind of like your resume, you know, like these are things that I've built. Look, you know, people kind of enjoy that, but there's a little bit more to it than that. There's the, for example, because you log in and have this portfolio of your own, you can like heart other people's pens, right? That's clear. That's nice. But what that does for you is it makes it easier to find again, for example. Mm-hmm. So you can go and look at the pens that you've hearted. And also, algorithmically from our end, it makes us be able to kind of recognize the pens that get a lot of hearts and use that data for stuff. So for example, if you go to CodePen and you click under the popular tab, we have an algorithm that we take that under account in, and we're able to kind of list pens in the order of how popular they are recently. And that's nice. That's a fun way to explore CodePen, but also we take that under consideration when you do search. So if you were to go to CodePen and search for fireworks, which would be a nice search for you to do today because it's, you know, being the 4th of July and stuff, you'll see a bunch of pens of people's attempts at making fireworks on CodePen, and they're kind of ordered in by popularity. So the ones that are towards the top of the search results are ones that have a lot of comments and hearts and shares and stuff like that. There's a whole algorithm that gets taken into account. So it may, you know, the more stuff that gets produced and the more community that's rolling at CodePen, the better, you know, resource it is for finding stuff like that. It makes it this really kind of a giant world's pattern library in a sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just did the search for fireworks. There are a lot of fireworks.
Yeah, and that's a pretty niche thing, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you know, imagine when you're looking for, you know, modal dialogue boxes in Angular or whatever. You'll mm-hmm. find that mm-hmm. stuff too, you know? Which is nice because all public pens on CodePen are MIT licensed, meaning that you're free to use it as long as that license comes along with it. So share and share alike. Pretty fun.
So when you look through CodePen and you see the different things that people are making, what kinds of things get you excited?
Well, lots of stuff. I'm actually, just because I'm so practical in what I build and work on and stuff, what the ones I'm drawn to are really nice typography, people that are, you know, doing that type of thing or working on like a simple interaction that we're all familiar with, but they're adding some whimsy to it or something, like a submit button. But this submit button is just really classy, like a little spinner slides out from it in a really kind of nice way and then retracts in a really nice way, and be like, ooh, you know, I'm always like, nice, I could use that, you know. Yeah. But there does need to be kind of a nice visual component to it for me to pick it to go to the homepage of CodePen, which is a very manual process. It's basically me clicking a little star icon. and those, you know, and so there's just a lot of people who are essentially making art on CodePen, really mm-hmm. beautiful artwork. And I tend to pick those a lot because it does matter, you know, when you go to the homepage of CodePen, it does need to look beautiful and enticing. And I think people put so much timing. I pick pens that people put a lot of time and care and effort into. And those, for whatever reason at the moment, tend to be these kind of art-based pens. And I love it.
Yeah, it's so easy to get lost in CodePen. Because you just, you know, you just keep clicking and then you try things and you move on. And it's yeah, a little sure. rabbit hole of
I get rabbit holed into individual people. Yeah. You know, you see one of their demos and you're like, what else? Is this what they do? And then you're like, yeah, it is what they do. Look at all their stuff. Wow.
Interesting. I wonder if you can see people's progression as well, you know, by looking at all their pens, if they've been doing it for a year or so and seeing, oh, this is where they started and this is where, you know, how they've grown.
Gosh, I hadn't even thought of that, but you surely could. There's one on the homepage right now. I go, his name is Thomas Hooper, and I've never heard of Thomas before, but he has this pen with these pink and green like lines in 3D that are kind of swooping around each other.
Yeah,
they're really nice. Right? I've never heard of Thomas. So click on Thomas Hooper's profile now. Notice he has one follower, which is me about 10 seconds ago. but look at all his work. So talk about a rabbit hole. Like that was that the green and pink lines are just the tip of the iceberg of things that he's been
making. There's so many other things. They're so awesome. Yeah.
You know. Wow.
I like the pastel donut. That's my favorite one so far.
Yeah. I like the ones that look like Christmas ornaments. Mm-hmm. Pretty fun. So yeah, you definitely can get lost in here, and I think that's the community thing is a big deal. You know, the fact that you can comment to each other and the little communities have developed here. I was at a meetup recently where two people just got engaged. I didn't know either of them, and they said, we met on CodePen. I was like, oh my god. You're kidding me.
Did you write a blog post about that? I hope you did.
I wanted to, and they weren't all about it, so I was like, okay, no problem, you know. Just because I don't know, maybe if I press the issue, but you know, like that's kind of personal stuff. So
yeah, no, that was the right thing to do. But still, that's great. That's awesome. Good for you.
And there's been little companies that have been formed, the little informal groups. There's been like weekends where people pick a theme and the community's just kind of rolled with it and made things on that theme. And I've like on purpose kind of not gotten involved with it. I'm like, you know what? You guys just roll with it, you know, or you team CodePen, go for it.
Yeah.
It's organized. There's a lot of people, but Tiffany Rayside really is an excellent CodePen member. So shout out, Tiffany. You're amazing. kind of puts them together a lot of times. And they've written in like, maybe we can make it official. And I'm like, maybe we could someday. But right now I'm really enjoying the fact that it's been 100% community organized, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like if we can help you in some way, great, but I don't, you know, we don't need to, I don't think you need anything from me necessarily.
Yeah. It's so great when the community cares so much that they, you know, run with an idea. Like they take it, they run with it, and they just make it better for everyone else.
Totally. And I think the communities, you know, we have a code of conduct that has been enforced very few times, which is nice, but it's nice that it's there. I feel like if you have one and your the vibe of me and the kind of a lot of the like people like Tiffany is so positive on CodePen that it breeds more positivity and helpfulness and stuff. And we tend to like nip anything negative in the bud right away because that, you know, we don't want this to, you know, whatever. We don't want to be the next Reddit. Hi-o.
Oh, that was good. Nicely done, Chris. Well done. I feel like the code of conduct makes it official, right? It's like if you already have a great community and everyone's really nice and happy and supportive, that's awesome. But if you have something to point to say, yeah, in case there are any questions, you know, this is our official stance, it just makes it a lot easier.
Yeah. Oh, and it has. Every time I need to invoke it, I feel good that we did it.
Mm-hmm, definitely. So next, let's move on to some rapid fire fill in the blanks. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. Number one, worst advice I've ever received is... you said you weren't ready, Chris.
The worst advice one. I said I worried about this one because it's hard to... It's hard to put a face on anybody, you know? Like, oh, gosh. We got some bad advice just because I'm struggling to think of one here. There's some fairly recent bad advice that we got from CodePen because CodePen is 100% bootstrapped. So we knew that there wasn't much cost associated with running a little site like this. And we were all willing to kind of take a risk on it. So we own 100% of CodePen and just are chugging away at it. But at some point we were interested in possibly taking some money or like, what would that mean to CodePen? What could we do with it? We're like, we should explore it because it seems kind of like, why not? A a lot of companies take that path, and we could probably put that to use in some way. And we talked to some VCs, and they're like, "What are you doing? You need to make all of this. you need to make all of this free immediately. All these little pro features you think you have, you throw that all away, and go and just because then you'll be the predominant player. You know, like that. If you offer all these things like collaboration and asset uploading and stuff, and you just make that free, you'd kind of definitely be ahead of the pack as to what's being offered here in this app, and you'd get a lot more traction, and traction is all that matters right now. You can figure out the rest of it later, kind of thing. And that was their firm position on it. And we're like, yeah, but we need to charge because we need to pay ourselves. And then, which is pretty cool.
Logical. Yeah.
Right. Because, you know, so like I might be able to live in a gutter, but Tim has two kids now and that's not going to fly. And, you know, you know, it seemed like really dumb. Plus, like our growth has been OK. And by charging, we're like kind of validating what people are willing to pay for. And like, it just seems like we're kind of headed in the right direction here. And everything they were saying was wrong. And I don't know, because you can't A/B test life, you know.
Oh, but wouldn't that be great?
Yeah, it really would. But it seemed like bad advice to me, and I'm holding to it.
Nice. So you do not regret not taking money?
No, it's not the money that I'm afraid of. It's the it would be the sacrifice everything for growth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like do whatever you can to get more users. I don't think is particularly good advice. Do whatever you can to like do right by the users that you have, and make money where it's appropriate to make money.
Mm-hmm. Number two, my first app was about.
Oh, I was speaking of pre-press days. That was back then when I was, and a detail I didn't mention about that is that one of my better pre-press jobs. I bounced around a little bit. Was when I worked the 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. the graveyard, and
oh, wow.
I was doing. Yeah, it was 3 days a week, so it was only 36 hours, and then he had 4 days off, which is pretty cool. But a lot of people are like, "Ugh, worst hours ever," and they were pretty bad. But there's stuff to like about it. If you really get into that lifestyle, you kind of have this kind of extended vacation every week. That's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. But during that time, I knew that I was trying to get out of it and get into the web world, and I was always working on little. So I had a good amount of downtime during the graveyard. I'd be working on my own site, or I'd be working on a band site or something. But one of the things I did was, because I did this job for like nearly a year, was. If I needed to get some kind of errand done, I'd have to find places. You know, I'm not living in New York here. There's not a lot of stuff that's open at the graveyard shift hours when I was awake. Mm-hmm. So the app was about like trolling through the city. I was living in Madison, Wisconsin at the time, and being this like app that knew all the stuff that was open at weird hours, stuff that was open 24 hours essentially. So it was pretty dumb, but it was like, these are the gas stations that are open 24 hours. These are the other things that are open 24 hours. It wasn't really an app necessarily. Yeah, it needed like a lot of user input, or it needed me driving around a lot more. And I never really like took off or anything. But the idea was to have it be like, you know, madison.247.com or something, you know, that ultimately could spread to other cities. But it's just, what is the business model there? You know, I had no idea. I just basically wanted the information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was my first app. Not a terrible idea, but not a great one either.
That's a pretty good, I like that idea. I think that's it. I like it because it solved your actual problem. You know, it wasn't like an arbitrary idea. It was for you.
Yeah. Yep. It should be. You know, when people talk about startups, some says they're like, I was just scratching my own itch. And you're like, yeah.
Hopefully you don't say it like that.
Well, I just feel like it's become kind of a cliche startup thing to say, but it's but it's because all good cliches, I guess, have a kernel of truth. You know, like I sure hope that you're doing something that you think you need. Mm-hmm. Like that would be weird to be working on something that you think is useless. Don't you? What are you doing?
Sad. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do something else. Number three. One thing I wish I knew when I first started to code is.
Everything is a rectangle. That's kind of one of my early realizations in CSS was that oh, I get it. All these elements are rectangles, and I I can influence what size they are and where they go, but they're all just rectangles. That was a CSS thing.
I like that realization. Wow, everything is a rectangle. Never thought of it that way before, but that's very true.
Like, here's a rectangle, here's a rectangle. If I float it to the left, there's still a rectangle, but it just influences where the other rectangles go.
So next, let's do some shout-outs. Do you have a couple for us?
Yeah, do you do shout-outs too, or is it guest-only shout-outs?
We both do shout-outs, but you go
first. Nice, yeah. Okay. Let's see. I want to shout out to the URL is ywebca.org. If you go there right this second, the website is okay, but I'm working on redesigning it with them. But it's a little, or have you heard of the YWCA? It's a national women's organization that's pretty badass. But it's this is the Madison chapter of the YWCA, but then within the Madison chapter, they're doing a kind of pilot program, and they're in their second semester now of teaching people to code, and it's teaching people of color and women to come, and it's free for them to come and like hardcore level up. So it's like several months long. It's a 400 hour class, and if you finish it, you get a free MacBook Pro. But MacBook Air, I think, but it's like hardcore learning. You learn Git and Node and HTML and CSS and JavaScript and design, and you make a portfolio, and they place you in an internship, and it's like this really awesome program to deal with the kind of the labor gap that is real. You know, everybody's hiring, you know, so we got to fill the gap here, and we all know that the gap, it would be nice to fill it with a little diversity for once. So that's what this thing is all about. And I've been kind of helping out with the doing their website design, and I've been mentoring a little bit and going in to talk a little bit. And I just think it's such a cool organization. So, and it's a pilot program. So if it does well, that YWCA could take it around the country or world a little bit more. So ywebca.org is the shout out there. Should I do another one?
Yeah, keep going.
Okay. There's there was a thing called the RICG, which was the Responsive Images Community Group. And community groups are a thing in the W3, the standards organization that standardizes things like CSS and JavaScript. And they encourage the creation of community groups when there's kind of a topic to be talked about to kind of direct the future of standards. So they encourage the creation of those community groups. One of them that was created was the RICG, the Responsive Images Community Group. And they were talking about how these days images on the web are kind of a hot topic because they're the thing that's kind of slowing down the web the most. The average website has all these huge images on it, and oftentimes they're so big because they need to be big for desktop, but that's really hurting the mobile world. And then all of a sudden these people's phones started coming out with retina displays and super high resolution displays. And so if you have a JPEG that's going to go on a website, all of a sudden now we're serving even bigger images to make sure that they don't look blurry and look and take advantage of those screens and stuff. And it's starting to become a big problem. And if the web is slow, the web kind of loses in a sense. It's a small topic that really has huge implications. And you know, the web is always kind of at risk in a battle that not everybody is maybe even aware of. But you know, we could the day could come where the web could essentially lose to native apps. You know, I don't know. I think it's worth worrying about. Not that we don't have enough stuff to worry about. but the responsive images came along, and they were like, okay, we need a way to handle this in HTML. We need a way to tell browsers, you know, can you download this image under these circumstances and this image under these circumstances to help fight against this downloading images that are too big for the situation at hand. And it was a really long, arduous battle, and big shout out to all the people that were involved with that. But they've essentially won this battle, or at least round one of it, and it's starting starting to land in browsers now, and it's the image with the source set tag and the picture element and stuff, and it's all it's all pretty interesting, if a little bit complicated of stuff to go into right now. But congratulations to them, and I just wanted to shout out that they've kind of changed their name into the Responsive Issues community group, which is not just images anymore, but other problems that we're facing in the responsive design world. And they've started to take on this idea of what we used to call element queries, which are, there's a thing called media queries on the web, which are a thing in CSS for shifting around layout and stuff based on, for example, how wide or tall the browser window is. Very useful. It's one of the fundamental important things in web design, especially around responsive design. But it's fairly limited, and the idea is that it would be nice if we could attach these same kind of media queries, but to individual elements instead of the entire browser window.
Yeah.
And it's been something that people have been wanting a lot, but there's some pretty hardcore hurdles in the way. It's very easy to write an infinite loop, for example, with an element query. You know, it says when this element query is 500 pixels, when this element is 500 pixels wide, apply this query, only to have something written inside of there that says makes that element 400 pixels wide. Then you're in an infinite loop situation. So that's one of the major hurdles that they have to face. But there's an article by Matt Markey in this month's A List Apart that talks about renaming them into and reframing how we think about it into container queries. That is just, is, you know, it's like a tiny little baby step forward. It definitely, they have not solved all of the stuff that goes into this, but they, you know, just because we saw them battle it and win with responsive images, I bet they'll end up battling it and winning it with what we're calling container queries now too. So shout out to that group and good luck with that battle, because we all could use it.
Very cool. Man, that was some really great information in that I had no idea about. That was really useful. Thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
Have any other ones?
I don't know. Shout out to the CodePen community. You're all doing a really good job. Shout out to some of the tech we use at CodePen that I'm happy with. CodeMirror is a very awesome open source project that is kind of powers the editor on a lot of popular apps like this, including CodePen. So if you're like, wow, how did they make a code editor work in the browser? Well, we didn't, but CodeMirror did, you know, and we do a lot with it. So CodeMirror is an active project that's really well done. So
yeah, I've always wondered about that functionality, because it seems to be pretty popular with, you know, a lot of learn to code type websites, and I've always wondered, like, how do they do that? But now I know.
Yeah, it's cool. We use CodeMirror, and keep doing a good job, CodeMirror.
We need you.
Yeah.
Don't mess up.
Yeah, that's it for me.
Sounds good. And I've got a few sponsored shout-outs. DigitalOcean's offering the CodeNewbie community a chance to try their cloud hosting service. Use the promo code CodeNewbie and get a $10 credit to get your app up and running. They've got easy one-click solutions for Django, Rails, and much more. And if you do try it out, let me know what you think. I'd love to hear it. And if you're looking for an immersive learn-to-code experience, definitely check out Dev Bootcamp. They are a 19-week immersive coding school in New York, Chicago, and San Francisco. It's perfect for code newbies like you and people with some coding experience. You can join a small cohort and learn with motivated peers from experienced instructors. And they've got full-time career coaches to help you get job ready. New cohorts start every 3 weeks. To learn more, go to devbootcamp.com/codenewbie for more information and to sign up for an info session or a private tour. For my personal shoutouts, I actually have two projects that I really liked on CodePen. One is something that I found a long time ago, actually, called Terrible Cloth. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, I could tell you a story about that.
Tell me a story about that.
Well, it's so popular that the numbers are orders of magnitude past other pens, you know? So the number of views it has is, I don't know how many views it has now. So like probably going on 3 million views. So when you're designing an algorithm to, it's 2.9 million views on it. When you're designing an algorithm to take into account the popularity of things, like when you have one outlier that has orders of magnitude more views, it's really hard to write that algorithm such that it's fair for all pens. So it's either the penalty is too high that we have to apply, so it gets taken down, but that hurts other pens disproportionately too much, or we write it so that it's fair to most of the other pens, but it's always number one. So yeah. Anyway, it's not a big deal. Like it's the most amazing pen ever, and if it sits at so number one cool. for, but it's been at number one for like going on 2 years. Mm-hmm. So it's one of those ones where we have to kind of write some special code around that particular pen to give some other pens some hope,
a chance. Yeah.
Yeah. And in fact, if you go and look at the details view for that pen, you'll see rainbows shooting off of the number of views, because I coded that specifically for that pen only, because it's so amazing that going on 3 million, I'll have to have a party for 3 million. But yeah. I'm sorry, we didn't explain the pen at all, but you could do that.
No one has any idea what we're talking about. Yeah, it is. I'm not really sure how to describe it. It's like a mesh net, I guess, that's kind of hanging. And if you use your mouse and you kind of drag it over, it will react just like a real mesh net would if it were hanging, you know, from a rod or a clothespin. And it, you know, it rips if you do it, you know, fast enough and hard enough, and it swings and it just, it's so incredible how interactive it is and how much it feels so alive. And it's really addictive. Like I've tried to see, you know, how much can I use my mouse without it actually ripping and just moving. And I've tried like chasing the cloth over to one side, and it's really, really incredible how interactive it is.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Mm-hmm.
My second code pen shout out that I really liked was the Wriggle Sphere version 2. I don't know if you've seen this.
I've seen everything.
Yeah, I was gonna say, you have these memorized, right? That was the impression I had. But yeah, it's really, really cool. And it's one of those interactive ones too. It's like this, it reminds you kind of like the lava lamp, like the stuff in the lava lamp where it, you know, kind of moves. And based on how you move your mouse, it kind of changes the shape and the, well, not really the shape, but more of the color and the direction. And it's just mesmerizing. I've just been staring at it for a really long time, an embarrassingly long time.
Yeah.
It's really, it's really fun. Yeah.
That's a good one. And it combines, it hits some of the right notes, because it's poly art, which is very popular right now. So I think that's hitting a nerve, and it's kind of got that 3JS look going on, that like, it's like, how is this in a web browser and so performant?
Yes.
It's amazing.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, exactly.
Which is, I think, is WebGL at work.
Mm-hmm. And it also kind of reminds me of dough, which makes me think that I can eat it. So that
that doesn't hurt, doesn't hurt. That's another person's profile that's worth digging into. I'm always happy to. So it's I'll murder it, but it's Kobayashi is his last name at Yoichi, I think. And you know, I've never met, but it's nice to see, because there's kind of a big demo scene in Japan, or there's some sites like this that where there's lots of Japanese code artists. And I like to see when they pop over and co-post things on CodePen, because I'm like, oh, it's all, you know, when I see Yoichi post something, I'm like, oh, this is going to be good. And if you see in the code for that one, sometimes I'm a little nervous clicking the button to go to the homepage, because it's not just their work. There's like four or five authors for each one of these that they kind of tag team it, but they're very good at giving each other credit, which is cool. But then I'm like, but who should get the, you know, who gets all the hearts?
We want one. Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting, because when there's that many people involved, I think it makes it more impressive, because it's, you know, how are you able to coordinate and communicate the final image and translate it into code and break up that code into pieces to delegate across a team? You know, because I feel like when it's something like art, it's easy for me to know what that should look like in my mind, but for me to explain that to other people before it's even built, and then to have that whole team execute, I think is really impressive.
It really is. And it leaves some mystery to it. You know, like, you might assume that some person wrote the interactive bit and some people built the, you know, so, but I almost suspect it's more of a forking situation, that somebody made the sphere and then somebody is like, oh, I'll colorize it. And somebody's like, you know, that maybe they didn't plan to work together, but just were inspired by each other and kind of left the author credits in place as they worked on it. But that's just total speculation. I have no idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the original author is like, this is not at all what this is supposed to look like.
Yeah.
Cool. So if you want to join the conversation, you can join us on Code Newbie Discourse, our new online forum for people excited about code, or you can chat with us every week on the Code Newbie Twitter chat. Just search for hashtag Code Newbie and tweet with us every Wednesday evening at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And if you didn't know, we also have our own Slack community, codenewbie.slack.com, so check that out as well. You can learn more about that as well as show notes on this episode at codenewbie.org/podcast. If there's a topic you want to hear about or a guest you want to hear from, send us an email, hello@codenewbie.org. Thank you again, Chris, so much for joining us. You want to say goodbye?
Yep. Thanks again so much for having me. It's been a great pleasure.
Thanks for listening. See you next week.